Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good morning. Unlike Robin, I can't thank our Neil Stewart Associates for the invitation to be here today. I'm a last-minute stand-in for Chris Enyu, who won the arm wrestle, and she's in Ghana this week for the opening of the university's West Africa office there. But although I'm not the invited speaker, I'd like to start by saying that I welcome events like this. Events in which we share knowledge and good practice around TNE developments. But they also make me a little bit afraid. I'm afraid that they're encouraging a bit of a gold rush mentality around TNE, with some UK universities seeing offshore developments as the answer to current and future funding concerns. We're seeing a really significant expansion in job opportunities in this area in our universities, and the development of new structures to support TNE developments. The UUK's international unit's global advisory service that we're going to hear about, and also the British Council's new transnational education service, which I quote, aims to help institutions develop and effectively market international programmes. It has dedicated TNE managers in country to provide bespoke support to identify the best opportunities for your courses, broker relevant partnerships, develop and execute marketing plans, and establish a clear route map through the local legal processes, including quality assurance frameworks. You know, Kevin, it wasn't that long ago that the British Council and some UK universities represented here today, saw the development of TNE, particularly overseas campuses, as a threat to traditional international student recruitment here in the UK. And you know, the British Council and my colleagues wouldn't even allow Nottingham to market its Malaysia campus at British Council exhibition and education events. You know, we've come quite some way in a relatively short period. And as colleagues have said and will continue to say, there are now more international students studying for a UK qualification overseas than based here in the UK. And we see TNE is helping the UK to maintain its market position in an incredibly competitive world of international student recruitment, as well as perhaps being an answer to some of the restrictions that are being placed on us by the government through the UK Border Agency. But TNE isn't new. Whatever form of TNE you're considering, someone else has probably already tried it. And many of today's new markets for TNE have probably had some form of TNE activity in them in the past. They just didn't know it was called TNE then. So with this said, what do I intend to cover in what remains of my 15-minute slot? I'd like to look a little bit more at the rationale for TNE. Why should we all jump on the bandwagon? Say something about the different forms of TNE before looking at market selection and choosing partners. Choosing partners has probably been the most difficult areas that we've struggled with at Nottingham. Something on risks, and finally, I'd like to end with Nottingham's approach, or at least the approach that we're aiming for and trying to develop. So, what's the rationale for TNE? The focus of much of the UK's recent activity has been commercial, international student recruitment and tuition fee income. But unless you're developing a short-term strategy, pile it high and sell it cheap, that's not a sustainable strategy, as we've seen from the numerous examples of retrenchment by the Australian universities. TNE activity can be and should be about much more than just international student recruitment. It can be about providing opportunities for your home students, engaging in mutually beneficial relationships with partners overseas for research, using it to meet your institution's responsibilities by supporting capacity development, and perhaps also to develop more interesting programmes by doing things together that we wouldn't be able to do on our own. I tried to develop a matrix showing which of the different forms of TNE activity met the different rationale, as I discussed on the previous slide. So, for example, the primary driver of validation and franchise activity being income, or twinning programmes about the development of secure student recruitment pipelines, or maybe campuses, at least the island campus model that has been developed by a number of US universities, as a means of providing opportunities for your home students. The reality, though, is that you could probably develop all of these models for a variety of purposes. So, for example, we at Nottingham have typically viewed twinning programmes, at least in recent years, as an international recruitment pipeline. We've got a twinning programme with Thammasat University in Thailand, which brings in 50-plus undergraduate engineering students a year. It's one of the reasons we're the top recruiter by quite some way in Thailand. But twinning programmes don't just have to be one way. They can be combined with joint or double degree activity. Back in the 1990s, when I worked at Sussex University, we had a twinning programme in economics with Grenoble University in France, which saw students start at two different institutions, join partway through their course, and travel together. The students graduated with a BA in economics from Sussex and a maîtrise from Grenoble. The primary driver of your executive MBA programme delivered on a flying model in Singapore might be about money, but exactly the same programme delivered in Ghana might be about supporting capacity development in that country. So having failed to produce a matrix looking at different forms of TNE and reasons for adopting them, I used a traditional matrix from the commercial sector looking at market development. You can choose to penetrate the markets in which you're already active by the development of additional activities, i.e. expanding your programme portfolio. There are numerous advantages of this approach, of course. You already know the area, you've got hopefully well-developed marketing channels and contacts, and the cost of launching programmes should clearly be less. Or perhaps once you've got a successful model in one country, you can try using that same model elsewhere. We've got a very successful PGCE programme that we launched in Nigeria about 4 years ago. We refined the model, and we now run the same programme in Thailand, UAE, Spain, and a whole series of other countries. Or perhaps the bravest approach, market and new activity development, starting from scratch in brand new markets. And no doubt some universities will adopt a combination of those approaches. Clearly, much depends on how quickly you need the development to take place, how long before it becomes viable, whether you're competing or working in collaboration with local domestic HE provision, and of course the legal and financial environment in which you'll be working. Are there educational hubs? What support or hurdles are available or in place from the local government? How easy is it to get work permits for your staff? And how easy or difficult is it to transfer money in and out of the country, etc.? So having said all of this, which countries should we look at for TNE developments? Well, we could go for the countries in which there's already a lot of TNE activity. Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, Pakistan, Ghana, etc. have all got more students taking UK qualifications in the country than here in the UK. Someone's already done the homework on these markets. There should be successful models in place which can be copied or competed with. Or maybe you want to put your effort into high potential growth markets such as the BRICS and the so-called N11, high volume markets that have potential for becoming the largest economies in the 21st century. Or maybe if research is your priority, then perhaps the Royal Society's G20 and the emerging research economies measured by research publications should be your starting point. Wherever you choose to work and whatever type of TNE activity you choose to develop, you're probably going to need partners. This is one of the most difficult debates that we've had at Nottingham and continue to have at Nottingham. Should we only play with universities like ourselves? Doing otherwise damages our brand, it's argued. Others have argued that we should focus on partners that need us, who can deliver now, or work with partners who we can support to develop capacity in line with our broader internationalisation strategies. Clearly, most of these universities wouldn't appear on any international ranking of universities. And then, of course, we're faced with the challenge of trying to balance longer-term potential against a quick return in established markets or with established programmes. And balancing the strategic selection versus opportunities that arise and come to you has also been difficult. Whoever you choose to work with, it's vital that you undertake a thorough due diligence. We're often very quick to start the courtship process by signing MOUs. But MOUs can soon develop into detailed MOAs, Memorandum of Agreement, and before you know it, you're married with commitments that you might find difficult to get out of. It's worth investing time and effort in the early stages of the relationship, because once you're married, divorce can be a costly process. Have you asked the right questions of and about your partner? Do they have the authority to enter into agreements? Have they got the resources to deliver? Are they financially sound? Can they deliver on their commitments? And do they share your vision? And have you checked and tested the promises that this potential partner is making? Do you, they have the permissions needed to do what you plan to do? Will the qualifications delivered locally be recognised? Can you get a financial return on this investment if that's one of your drivers? And what happens if something goes wrong? Do you have appropriate remedies in place? Can you seek appropriate advice? Does the partnership add to or compete with your existing activities? And crucially, have you got the staff to manage these activities overseas? At Nottingham, we've tried to develop our own rough T&E risk scale, one looking at quality and another looking at financial risk. These scales are far from perfect, and I'm not advocating that anybody uses the Nottingham scales, but I'd encourage you to develop your own risk scales. So in terms of our own risk scale, perhaps surprisingly, we see campuses as low risk. Our staff teach our degree programmes, so the risk to quality is low, whereas we see franchise and validation agreements as high risk because of a lack of control. The financial risk scale is almost the opposite for us. But clearly, different universities will draw the risk scale differently depending on local factors and the scale of the activity that you're undertaking. But whatever you choose to do, and whatever level of risk you think is acceptable, it's vital to have an exit strategy in place in case things go wrong. Or as in the case of the University of South Australia, a new vice-chancellor brings a different institutional strategy. The route we've chosen at Nottingham is to develop a portfolio of activity which recognises the need for diversity of activity and diversity of markets, and one which ideally takes a long-term view, recognises that different forms of delivery can be equally valid and equally good, that encourages internationalisation at home and the development of T&E as a means of providing new opportunities for home students, and one that actively promotes mobility for staff and students. But no matter how good your strategy is, it needs to be underpinned by strong systems in finance, student records, HR, and your international office. Can your student record systems cope with T&E developments? Have you got finance and HR systems in place which can cope with offshore activities? I know that we've really struggled in this area, and we've had campuses now in Malaysia for more than 10 years, and we don't have a unified student record. And you'll need staff development programmes in place to ensure that your existing staff can cope with these activities and that the new staff that you recruit have got appropriate skills to manage T&E developments. So in conclusion, to be a successful T&E player, the institution needs, in our view, a clarity of vision. Understand why you want to develop T&E activity. You've got to properly resource it, put time and effort in early. That's much more cost-effective than getting things wrong and having to pull out. You only have to look at the University of South Australia and the teams of people that they have working on pulling out of T&E activity. Be flexible in what you'll consider, and be flexible in the different forms of delivery that you think are valid. Build clear positions around your different activities in the markets, articulating what it means clearly for the student, their parents, your staff in your institutions, and of course for your partners. And finally, ensure that you give proper attention to those underpinning systems, those student records and the staff that are going to work in your institution. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.